So, can everybody hear me? Well, okay. So I'd like to say, first of all, that I have had to say, and I will say again, I am not per se against the gun. I'm not against the Second Amendment. I'm in favor of regulation of the Second Amendment, and we're in a situation where it is completely and utterly unregulated by the forces that I'm going to critique today. I felt like I should say that first off. Secondly, I wanted to tell you a little bit about how I got into this. I am a philosopher, and my specialty is political philosophy. My only experience with guns growing up, we lived on a farm, my dad had a shotgun. I like to eat hunted stuff. That's all fine and good. I was not writing about the NRA. I was not writing about the gun issue. And then Sandy Hook happened. In the Sandy Hook episode, that was December 12th, 2014, in Connecticut, in the elementary school. You may remember a disturbed young man barged in. He killed the principal, and then he killed 20 first graders and their teachers. And then he turned the gun on himself. And I have to credit the idea with my work on this and my book, the main idea by my book. I have to credit my 12-year-old with the idea for it. He's now 16. We were in the car that day. Some of you may remember that day. And NPR, the news was, it was all about that shooting, right? That's all they talked about. And I have four kids. I had them all in the car. We were planning my 12-year-old's birthday party. It was going to be he was going to take his friend to see The Hobbit at a movie theater. And we were talking about that, and then the thing came on NPR, and my instinct was to turn it off, but my wife, you know, is smarter than me. She said, you've got to turn it up. They have to hear the gory details, and then we have to talk to them about it. And so we put it on. We let them listen. It went on seemingly forever. Then I turned it off, was ready to field questions, and there were no questions. Except my 12-year-old son said, Dad, I don't want to go to school anymore. And then he said, I don't want to go to the movies either. And he was thinking of just that summer, there had been a movie theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado. And that's when this idea hit me that our freedom is gravely hindered by this armed society and all the threats it poses. So a couple things. I'm going to get into the talk now. The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership, private gun ownership in the world. It's not even close, by the way. A recent Harvard Public Health study puts the number at around 260 million. 40% of the world's private arsenal is in America. We comprise less than 5% of the world's population. We have 40% of the civilian-owned guns. The country next in line in terms of private gun ownership is Yemen, at just over half our rate of gun ownership, by the way. And Yemen, I like to point out, is embroiled in a civil war. Among industrialized nations, the United States has by far the highest gun fatality rate. No industrialized nation has anything close to the number of mass shootings we do. This gun violence epidemic is a uniquely American problem for society not officially at war. Other industrialized democracies have decided after grisly mass shootings to tighten gun control. England, for example, did so after the massacre at Dunblane, Scotland in 1996 when a shooter killed 16 school children and their teacher. Australia also imposed stronger gun control restrictions after the Port Arthur massacre, also in 1996, when a shooter killed 35. Australia enacted a gun buyback and subsequently diminished the nation's private arsenal by a third. Gun violence subsequently fell in both countries. By 2013, gun deaths in Australia had fallen 50% to 208, of which 35 were homicides. That's the number for the whole year. Where I come from in Baltimore, that's what we get in a month. Gun deaths in England over the same period fell 42% to 144, of which 23 were homicides, again in England, over the entire year. Even while the overall crime rate has fallen over the last 20 years in America, gun deaths have risen 17% since 1999, with an average of about 30,000 per year. Two-thirds are suicides, one-third are homicides. With each mass shooting in the United States over the past decade, the gun rights movement has argued for expanding gun rights and has largely gotten its way. after Sandy Hook. Many said the time had finally come to strengthen gun laws. The nation and the NRA could not deny this or shrink from it now. And the NRA CEO, Wayne LaPierre, held a now famous press conference a week after Sandy Hook, when it was supposed he was going to admit as much. Instead, he doubled down on uncompromising gun rights. The problem, he said, was not too many guns, but too few. And not enough in the hands of the right people. The fact that schools were gun-free zones, he said, that's the problem. It made them likely targets in the first place. The solution was to get more guns in our schools. We need armed guards and, in addition, armed teachers, principals, and staff. The only solution to an armed bad guy, LaPierre said, is an armed good guy. After Sandy Hook, there appeared to be momentum behind stronger gun control regulations, and with bipartisan support in Congress, President Obama pushed a bill enacting universal background checks for all gun transactions, a very popular and eminently common sense gun control measure, but the NRA blocked it. It rallied its allies in Congress. Some states garnered attention for issuing stronger gun control measures after Sandy Hook, New York, Maryland, Connecticut, Colorado. And yet, the New York Times reported that in the year following the school massacre, almost twice as many new state gun laws had loosened gun control in the year after Sandy Hook as opposed to strengthening it. So the contrast I wanted to draw is that where other industrialized democracies, they double down on restrictions after shootings, we have been going in the other direction, steadily loosening gun laws in response to these massacres. What's going on here? Why does the U.S. defy the trend seen in other industrialized democracies and expand gun rights with each mass shooting? Why do we tolerate this obscene death toll and widespread misery? Why is the NRA's radical agenda ascendant? A word about the NRA's radical agenda. It includes campus carry. This is the right of students and faculty to carry guns on public university campuses, now legal in 10 states and counting. Most recently, it was legalized in Texas last year. All the leadership in the universities and the vast majority of the faculty opposed it, as did major student bodies. The state went ahead and legalized it anyway. Private universities were allowed to enact their own campus carry bills. Only one did in the entire state of Texas. That tells you something about how university leadership feels about it. The NRA radical agenda also includes open carry and the right to carry guns in a greater number of public places. According to Georgia's recent law expanding the gun the places where armed citizens can carry guns, this was dubbed the Guns Everywhere Bill in Georgia. This includes bars and restaurants, airports and government buildings, also churches if the pastor says okay. The NRA's radical agenda also includes stand your ground laws, which I will talk about a lot today. These laws permit citizens to use deadly force against perceived threats. A notoriously subjective and fraught determination. Predictably, this law has given rise to numerous publicized controversies, and Stand Your Ground has been enacted by 24 states since 2005. One such controversy, which you probably know, is the Trayvon Martin shooting in 2012, I believe. Now the NRA pushes for constitutional carry, aka permitless carry. This was legalized. This is legal in 10 states. Approved in New Hampshire last week. You do not need a permit for concealed carry anymore, and what that means is you don't need safety training. This is the new thing that the NRA wants to push state by state. And of course, the NRA resists universal background checks. In most states, anyone can purchase a gun in a private sale or on the internet without going through a background check. And under the Trump administration, the NRA has promised to go on the offensive. What will we see? Eased restrictions on the sale of silencers and armor-piercing bullets look to be on the agenda. There is another front of the NRA's radical agenda that is very important, but which gets less press. The greatly hobbled ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. This is the federal agency that's charged with tracking and stemming the flow of illegal guns and halting licensed dealers who engage in illicit sales. So it's a pretty important regulatory body. The NRA has basically made it impossible for the ATF to do its job. because the gun lobby has convinced allies in Congress to slash the agency's funding, and it has also persuaded Congress to create legal barriers to the ATF and its ability to do its job. For example, the ATF has fewer agents than it did 40 years ago. It is prohibited from compiling a national database of retail firearm sales. That's why the best Harvard can do is give an estimate how many guns are in this country. No one knows for sure. It is prohibited, the ATF is prohibited from conducting annual inventories of gun dealers' merchandise to see if any is stolen or missing. It is prohibited from conducting more than one inspection of a single gun dealer in a given year. The NRA rebuts the prospect of universal background checks by saying that criminals won't submit to them. In other words, background checks don't work. To which I say, we don't really have them, or we might as well not have them. We are hardly doing all we can to ensure that background checks work. How are background checks supposed to be effective in one state or in one jurisdiction when criminals can simply go to a neighboring state and purchase guns in a private legal transaction with no background checks and no questions asked? The NRA and gun rights advocates like to mock the city of Chicago for its very strong gun restrictions, and they say, look what gun restrictions do. They don't do anything against violence. And of course, Chicago right now has pretty high gun violence. But the problem in Chicago is pretty clear. It's surrounded by three major jurisdictions that have zero background checks. So if you want to commit a crime in Chicago, you simply leave the city limits, you buy your gun, and no one will ask any questions. Taken together, this radical agenda, what I've been discussing, this is nothing less than an experiment in radical gun rights that we, the American people, are subjected to. And it's an experiment in gun rights, and that's what I want you to understand. This is an experiment in gun rights such as the nation has never experienced or undergone. The NRA, this radical agenda is a recent development. As recently as the late 1990s, Wayne LaPierre himself approved of universal background checks and campus carry, permitless carry, and stand your ground. These new legislative efforts, these are all relatively new. The first states enacted them a little over a decade ago. Gun rights advocates like to claim that these radical gun laws, like permitless carry, which they conspicuously and tellingly dub constitutional carry, they like to argue that these are perfectly natural for this nation, fitting in seamlessly with our gun culture, or carrying it on or reclaiming it, just as our forefathers would have wanted. Nothing could be further from the truth. We have not had laws like this in the past. Stand Your Ground, for example, is a departure from centuries of legal tradition. Before Florida enacted the first Stand Your Ground law in 2005, legal practice was that if threatened, you had a duty to retreat, if possible. Only if retreat was impossible could you use deadly force to protect yourself. Stand Your Ground is a new law that exonerates armed citizens of that duty to retreat. Now you can stand your ground if you feel threatened. We'll talk about what that means. And you can shoot to kill. No duty to retreat. Gun rights advocates like to say they are following the tradition of our founding fathers and carrying forth the original use and intent of the Second Amendment. But legal historian Saul Cornell, professor up at Fordham, has pointed out that in fact gun restrictions were much stronger in early America. And they were not the kind of things contemporary gun rights advocates would tolerate. In colonial America, Cornell tells us, citizens were required to have a firearm in order to fulfill their civic duty to serve in a local militia. In turn, they were required to store them safely and take care of them, both of which were subject to inspection by the authorities, and gun owners were required to demonstrate that they could use their firearm effectively. So this is all very far from permitless carry. Polls indicate that the American people are not on board with the NRA's radical agenda. There is broad support for gun control measures. For example, after Sandy Hook, when President Obama pushed for universal background checks, polls revealed that over 90% of Americans from both sides of the aisle, and as a matter of fact, they favored this policy. Multiple polls revealed that a majority of Missourians who recently, the state of Missouri last year approved permitless carry, and polls revealed that a majority of state residents They didn't approve of that legislation, but legislators approved it anyway. Majority of Georgians objected to that state's guns everywhere law, but the same thing happened. Legislators ignored the will of the people and approved it. And a majority of Floridians have enacted reforms to the state's Stand Your Ground bill after the Trayvon Martin shooting in 2012. And once again, state legislators ignored the will of the citizens, too. What's going on here? I'm gonna give an anecdote here that I think illuminates the recurring practice. In 2012, after the shooting at in Aurora, Colorado, in the movie theater, James Holmes, he assaulted a midnight showing of The Dark Knight Rises. He killed 20 and he injured 70. Colorado issued new safety measures, including gun safety measures, including a law to close the private gun sale loophole. So they imposed universal background checks, but just in that state. And they issued a ban on large capacity ammunition magazines, like those used in the Aurora shooting. Also at Columbine High School, which was in 1999. Gun rights groups in that state were livid about the new laws enacted by the Democrat-controlled State House, and they targeted four Democrat lawmakers for recalls in 2013. Two of those lawmakers lost, including the Senate president. Both he and the other victim of the recall represented Democrat-leaning districts. For the other victim, his district was heavily Democrat. So what happened? Why were they turned out of office by this gun rights push? It turns out that the gun rights supporters came out in droves. Not so the Democrats and the moderates who favored gun safety measures. This is the story that has been repeated over and over again. There is a silent majority that favors gun safety measures, but there is this gun rights minority that is especially passionate. They tend to be what we call single-issue voters. And the gun safety voters, they just do not punish lawmakers who defy their will in gun laws. The gun rights minority gets to drive this debate, and it is responsible for pushing the NRA's radical agenda. A few words about this gun rights minority. This recent Harvard study on gun ownership demographics that I was talking about at the opening is pretty illuminating. The radical gun rights movement charges along on the legislative front. It's racking up all these legal victories, or legislative victories, I should say. And yet the number of guns in America and the guns, the brute arsenal in America is growing, it's ballooning. And yet, the percentage of Americans who own a gun has actually fallen over the last 20 years, from 25% of the population to 22%. And at the same time, the percentage of households with a gun has fallen dramatically by a third since the 1970s. And then this Harvard study points out that gun ownership is even more concentrated than we thought. They concluded that 3% of the gun owners in America own half the guns. 3% of gun owners own half the guns. These have been dubbed super owners, and they have on average 17 guns apiece. The nation is poised to turn back the NRA and demand stronger gun control laws, but the movement is stymied or stalled. It has been going backwards in recent years, even while it should have the momentum. There are copious amounts of public health evidence attesting to the many dangers of proliferating guns and loose gun laws. We also have ample data attesting to the success of gun safety laws, regulations, and restrictions in other countries. The contrast is stark. Though the NRA prevents Congress from funding the NIH and the CDC, the CDC Center for Disease, what does the CDC stand for? Oh, I was right. Centers for Disease Control. And what does the NIH stand for? National Institute of Health? Nice. The federal government at the NRA behest has blocked funding on gun violence studies from these two federal agencies. And so private universities have had to pick up the task here, Harvard, Hopkins, and Stanford in particular. And there's plentiful and abundant and very clear public health studies coming out of these universities that prove the the violence that is inflicted at the hands of these plentiful guns. On the one hand, you have public health evidence that is standing against the NRA. On the other hand, you have legal historians. And they argue that the NRA reads or interprets the Second Amendment wrongly. The NRA argues that the Second Amendment enshrines an individual right to bear arms, increasingly one that is absolute too, as opposed to a collective right to bear arms, which may be regulated. Now, I probably should quote the Second Amendment this time, but I can't. But I will tell you the term militia is in the preamble of the Second Amendment. And this suggests that our founders had a collective right to bear arms in mind, and the Supreme Court agreed with that reading of the Second Amendment for the entire previous century. Suddenly, it ruled otherwise in a split decision in 2008, D.C. versus Heller. Even then, and agreed that the NRA, okay, it is an individual right to bear arms, and that has a whole host of different implications. But even then, this conservative court that offered this decision held that this right is not absolute. Antonin Scalia, he wrote the majority opinion, and he said himself that the right to bear arms can be regulated. And yet the NRA ignores this and beats back any and all regulations, no matter how small, modest, or minute. The NRA insists on an individual and absolute right to bear arms as the only proper reading of the Second Amendment. So the question is, why hasn't the convincing public health data on one hand and the arguments offered by legal scholars and historians on the other hand, why haven't these rebuffed or slowed the NRA? One answer, I think, is that the NRA has been very effective in driving a particular political narrative about guns. Guns are tantamount to freedom in this democracy. We only have a democracy at all thanks to an armed populace. The point of an armed populace is to beat back or threaten would-be tyranny in our government. In his book, Gun Guys, Dan Baum, he's a journalist, he uncovered a similar point when he quotes an ardent gun rights supporter. Quote, "You on the left look at the problem like gun violence and say, we have to do something. We on the right are more inclined to say, we are a big, messy, polyglot nation with an extraordinary amount of freedom. And a certain number of bad things are bound to happen. Where'd you get the idea that you can limit gun violence without infringing on people's rights?" End quote. In that vein, I've argued the NRA aims to corner the market on freedom. For example, the NRA's magazine for members is called First Freedom. It sends its members on freedom cruises in the Caribbean, where they can be regaled by gun rights strategists and evangelizers, and the NRA tells members to vote freedom first and support absolute gun rights. As to another prong of the NRA's political argument for expansive gun rights, consider this popular claim issued by conservative columnist Andrew Napolitano in the Washington Times shortly after Sandy Hook, and he issued this in the face of growing calls for gun control at the time. Quote, "The Second Amendment was not written to protect hunters' rights to shoot deer," he said. "The Second Amendment was written to protect our rights to shoot at tyrants and to shoot at them effectively." End quote. This statement illustrates how the political claims of the NRA are devastating for common sense public health arguments for stronger gun safety regulations. If the point of having a gun is to beat back tyranny, then what kind of regulations are acceptable? Assault weapons bans? Bans on high-capacity magazines? Bans on machine guns? None. You need unfettered access to any and all high-powered weaponry if the point of having them is to take on tyrannical government. You should probably have a tank and some drones as well. Gun rights advocates also argue that the Second Amendment protects all the rights we enjoy. At the National Press Club in Washington in 1997, former NRA chief and actor Charlton Heston gave a famous speech. He declared that, quote, "gun rights is the first among equals." He told the journalists assembled there that day that they only do what they do and enjoy freedom of the press thanks to civilian gun ownership, which protects them against tyrannical government. Our rights to free speech, free assembly, even to worship as we want, he maintained. These are all protected by the right to bear arms. So, thinking about this, I decided that a lot could be gained for the cause of gun safety by pulling apart and debunking the NRA's political claims. So I'm going to sketch my responses to the NRA's political arguments, and then I'm going to talk about a Christian critique in particular. To the claim that the Second Amendment was written to give a democratic people the ability to combat tyranny, this argument has a legitimate political or philosophical pedigree. It invokes the political thinking of the founding fathers, the times in which they lived, and the philosophers who inspired them. In particular, the founders, they were wary of centralized power and constructed our government to limit it and to prevent said centralization from happening as far as possible. But the gun rights movement does no service to this reading of the Second Amendment, I've argued, for it advances an individual right to bear arms, while a collective right to bear arms seems to pose a more credible threat to tyranny. The NRA offers only a loose collection of unaffiliated, unorganized gun owners to combat government tyranny. There are super owners out there with 17 guns apiece, but they are not affiliated, organized, or trained. How is this loose collection of unaffiliated gun owners supposed to take on our government? Our government, which has the most sophisticated military on earth at its disposal. This seems like an implausible proposition at best. As to Charlton Heston's claim that the right to bear arms ensures protects all the rights we enjoy, pushed to a certain degree, I argue, gun rights undermine our other rights and make us considerably less free. With the proliferation of guns and gun-friendly laws, and guns invading nearly every public space, the Second Amendment threatens to undermine the First. Guns do not invite speech, they chasten it. Guns are of their nature threatening and isolating, and if you want any affirmation of this, just ask gun owners. They are happy to affirm that their guns communicate as much. Open carry advocates tout the virtues of their practice. Their guns say, "Don't mess with me, leave me alone. I'm prepared to kill you if you seem threatening." To that extent, guns risk compromising our public spaces, but a democracy requires vibrant public spaces where interaction and discourse can take place freely. When guns undermine that discourse, they undermine our democracy at large. And one place in which I think this is highly sensitive is the college classroom. I've written a lot on the campus carry movement. I've argued that campus carry is a terrible idea for the free speech concerns stemming from proliferating guns, in addition to the outrageous public health risks they pose on campuses. I won't get into that. I was a college student. I know what the public health risks are on campuses, as do you, I assume. Guns in the classroom, I've argued, promise to undermine the pedagogical purpose of the classroom and the civic mission of the university. John Dewey, a famous American philosopher, he said that the classroom is vitally important to and in a democracy because that is where the all-important process of socialization takes place. School is important to a democracy, he wrote, not because of the information transferred there or the talents learned. That can happen in any setting, one-on-one, for example, or at home. By contrast, Dewey maintained, the classroom is crucial to a democracy because it introduces people of different backgrounds, perspectives, and traditions to one another, and they have to learn to negotiate differences, talk with one another, work out compromise peacefully, just as they will have to do in democracy at large when they are citizen adults. What's more, I've argued, in the college classroom, the humanities classroom where I teach, young adults must be brought out of their shell. They must be invited to open up, take risks in laying out their convictions or prejudices, take risks in adopting lines of argument that are controversial, perhaps even offensive to some people. Guns in the classroom stand against this experimental aspect of the pedagogical experience at the university level. Guns certainly will not make students more likely to speak out. The guns and the threat they issue promise to quell the debates that we must have in the classroom Most devastating of all, I've argued that the agenda of the NRA undermines rule of law, an invisible but essential bedrock institution of this democracy. Elsewhere in my job, I teach political philosophy and the emergence of democracies. Rule of law is an incredibly elusive institution, takes generations, if not centuries, to achieve and establish. And we are flirting with it, with this gun rights agenda. Rule of law, what is it? It is this basic trust that we have that other people will behave in lawful and predictable fashion. You typically notice rule of law when it is absent. It is this basic belief that we will not have to take the law into our own hands, definitively, on certain occasions, or that someone else will do that too. This basic trust enables me and everyone to get on with your daily business. Thanks to open carry and stand your ground in particular, I've argued the NRA undermines the notion that rule of law pertains, that it governs or exists in any given setting, which delivers a potentially devastating blow to society. The pervasive suspicion that we are not safe in our daily dealings, that daily life is entirely too unpredictable. While I focused my efforts on a political critique of the gun rights movement, I've also sought to articulate a Christian response, which I'm going to talk about now. Given the tenuous demographics of the radical gun rights support, the fact that gun ownership is so highly concentrated, and the radical gun rights advocates are in fact few, and given the nature of popular support for strong gun safety measures, popular support that only needs to be galvanized, I think we're at a point where faith-based communities, and Christian communities in particular, can provide a powerful push for gun control. So I'm Catholic, and as a Catholic, I focus my attention on the Catholic Church and its potential for leadership here. The NRA's agenda clearly contradicts church teaching, in particular Catholic social teaching, and this is no small thing, since Catholics are an important voting bloc. And if mobilized, they could strongly empower the gun safety movement. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has endorsed stronger gun control regulations. In particular, they have supported laws that promote gun safety and make it harder for criminals to access guns. The Archbishop of Chicago, Blaise Cupich, has been especially vocal on this issue, unsurprisingly. He has argued that the nation's gun violence epidemic must be a priority because the Catholic Church calls on us to, quote, act in ways that promote the dignity and the value of human life, unquote. And New York Archbishop Dolan has actually called gun control a pro-life issue on numerous occasions. I want to hear more of this. The Church has not yet infected parishes and the faithful with the same kind of passion that we see on other church-favored issues like abortion, death penalty, lately immigration. This must change. The proliferation of guns in society and the NRA's objection to safety regulations of any kind victimizes populations of special concern for the church. Vulnerable populations that the gospel has charged us with protecting. Gun violence in the United States disproportionately afflicts poor and minority communities, especially urban black communities. Writing in The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg says that between 1980 and 2013, 262,000 black males were killed in America, the vast majority from guns. The murder rate for African Americans is 8 times higher than it is for whites and 12 times higher than other developed nations. This according to the blogger Nate Silver. The closest comparable murder rates are in the developing world, he says. The medical journal Pediatrics reports that over 7,000 children are hospitalized or killed due to gun violence every year. Many such children die by mishandling guns that are too easily accessed in the home. The rate of such deaths is 9 times higher than in other developed nations. But the gun lobby blocks safe storage laws. There are none, not in a single state in this country, that are at least required. These safe storage laws would mandate that guns be locked up and unloaded, for example. Inexplicably, the NRA has also blocked smart gun technology, which is available and which would make guns operable only by their owners. And 2/3 of gun fatalities in the U.S. are suicides. Public health researchers have long argued that guns are too easy to access for individuals with mental health ailments. Our suicide rate, they argue, could be significantly lowered if we made it harder for the mentally ill to access guns. Instead, however, Congress just reversed a bill requiring the Social Security Administration from reporting mentally ill beneficiaries to the background check system. And now Congress, just saw this yesterday, Congress looks to do the same with the Veterans Administration. The NRA argues that people who kill themselves with guns were going to do so anyway. That's their line. And that is simply not true. It is a truism in public health circles that when you make it harder for individuals to kill themselves, many will reconsider or resist, sparing family and friends deep grief. The gun rights position is overly simplistic and intolerably callous. We must work to limit access to guns as an act of mercy for all those who suffer depression and those who care about them. I've argued that the agenda of the contemporary gun rights movement threatens the very basis of civil society. It also threatens the Catholic Church's teaching of the common good. Consider again Stand Your Ground. This law effectively emboldens gun owners to use their weapons in public when they so much as feel a threat of bodily harm. It was appealed in the case of Curtis Reeves. He killed an unarmed man, he argued with, in a Tampa movie theater in 2014. His opponent stood over Reeves and flung popcorn in his face, and then Reeves drew his gun and fired, killing him. Reeves' lawyer said his client didn't know at the time if his opponent was armed. He didn't know his opponent's only weapon was popcorn. Reeves felt threatened at the time, and his lawyer argued, per the letter of the law, that is enough. After much deliberation and several years' interval, Reeves was finally denied Stand Your Ground immunity by a judge just last Friday, actually. It took 2.5 years. But his case is very illuminating, and it's a prominent warning nonetheless. His lawyer understood aptly what Florida's Stand Your Ground law does, and which many judges have actually affirmed. And it's this: shooters only need to feel a threat, even if mistaken. They only need to cite a feeling of threat to make a case for Stand Your Ground immunity. And in many cases, the judges have sided with them, even if there was no credible or tangible threat. In a Stand Your Ground society, it makes increasing sense to suspect and fear those around you. You don't know what weapons they have, how they might use them, of what complaint or conflict, no matter how trifling. Consider George Zimmerman. He confronted the unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin because he deemed Martin suspicious. What if your neighbor on the street, like Zimmerman, thinks you look suspicious? And like Zimmerman, he confronts you. Stand Your Ground urges everyone to assume the worst and be prepared for the worst. Indeed, since Florida's Stand Your Ground law was enacted in 2005, concealed carry permits in that state have tripled. More people are carrying guns on the street, perhaps posing as other George Zimmermans or ready to rebuff would-be George Zimmermans. Thomas Aquinas affirmed that we are political by nature and that the aim of the political community is to advance the common good. The personal success and welfare of each of us is bound up with the common good, and we can't hope to advance our individual goals without contributing to and protecting the integrity of the common good. According to a doctrine of the Catholic Church called the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church, 2004. I'd like to read this quote. The human person cannot find fulfillment in himself apart from the fact that he exists with others and for others. This truth does not simply require that he live with others, but that he seek unceasingly in actual practice the good found in existing forms of social life. Unquote. Cooperation and interaction are necessary conditions of this social life, but Stand Your Ground and other expensive gun laws threaten to drive people apart. They sow and validate mutual mistrust. Gun rights advocates have several memorable, pithy sayings. Here's one: an armed society is a polite society. An armed society is a polite society. That is, guns spread liberally throughout society will cause criminals to think twice or will warn anyone against being rough or offensive at pain of death. But ultimately, I've argued, an armed society will also discourage people from approaching one another, reaching out to one another, speaking to one another. What if armed people interpret you as a threat and are protected by stand your ground laws to shoot you? An armed society stifles charity, urging you to view strangers primarily as a threat. What's more, this quote invokes an armed society that is uncomfortable, tenuous, electric. The NRA recipe for peace sounds more like a tense standoff between armed parties. This is no recipe for lasting social peace and security. The theologian Jacques Maritain reveals how an armed society violates natural law. Quote, each one of us has need of others for his material, intellectual, and moral life. But also because of the radical generosity inscribed within the very being of the person. Because of that openness to the communications of intelligence and love, which is the nature of the spirit, and which demands an entrance into relationship with other persons. Unquote. We are outwardly directed and disposed by nature. We require the contribution of and interaction with others just to live, much less flourish. On our own, we are incomplete, not fully human. The Catholic Church teaches that we must work in and with a political community, advancing the common good in order to perfect our nature. By contrast, there is a very dark vision of the world and humanity in the gun rights movement. Indeed, this is necessary to advance this radical agenda. Consider this quote from Wayne LaPierre at the 2014 CPAC conference. Quote, in the world that surrounds us, he said, there are terrorists and home invaders, drug cartels and carjackers, knockout gamers and rapers, haters, campus killers, airport killers, shopping mall killers, road rage killers, killers who scheme to destroy our country with massive storms of violence against our power grids or vicious waves of chemicals or disease that could collapse the society that sustains us all. Unquote. His argument, rule of law, is nearly gone. We live in a society that is a veritable hellhole. These doomsday pronouncements are not idle or harmless. In the hands of the NRA, they become a self-fulfilling prophecy. A proliferation of guns, increasingly prevalent in public spaces, openly carried and openly used in stand-your-ground states, this all contributes to or gives the suspicion that rule of law does not exist. People without a gun feel the need to get one because of the fallen world around them, or to protect themselves against all the gun owners emboldened by our expansive gun laws, practicing permitless carry, for example, with no safety training. George Zimmerman's practicing vigilante justice. Thus, the NRA and allies contribute to the lost rule of law they bemoan. By sinking universal background checks, they ensure that criminals, terrorists, and the mentally ill can readily access powerful weapons. Of course, undermining rule of law, this is good for the NRA's business. LaPierre also said, in this uncertain world, surrounded by lies and corruption, there is no greater freedom than the right to survive. The right to protect our families with all the rifles, shotguns, and handguns we want. Unquote. The Catholic Church, for one, maintains higher aspirations. The compendium says, quote, the human being is a person, not just an individual, and does not find complete self-fulfillment until he moves beyond the mentality of needs and enters into that of gratuitousness and gift, which fully corresponds to his essence and community vocation. Unquote. We require the common good in order to be charitable, to practice charity, to be open to others, and thereby to Christ, to invite God's grace. The doctrine of the common good urges Catholics to turn back the radical and nightmarish agenda of the NRA, which drives us apart and impairs us and limits us as individuals, human beings, and God's creation. Thank you.
Thank you. We have some time for questions and answers. Shay, is there anything we need to be mindful of in recording this during the Q&A?
It picks up pretty well, but...
I'll stand here.
Okay.
Repeat the question. Yes.
So your
Could you please stand up when you ask your question? Thank you.
Your critique mostly focuses from a Catholic perspective.
Yes.
I was wondering, do we know like the distribution of this sort of gun from gun like promoting minority in terms of its evangelical versus Catholic distribution, or just gun ownership and pro-gun? Because I know, I mean, like I have friends that are Catholic and are pro-gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a big question to repeat. So he's basically asking about the religious breakdown of maybe radical gun rights support. I had this conversation with Dr. Marsh last night. I don't actually know, but I think your impression is correct that you will find a bigger representation amongst self-professed evangelicals, conservative Christians who are not of the Catholic leaning. Because, as I was saying to Dr. Marsh last night, I can't think of a single... While there are prominent evangelical leaders who have spoken out in favor of the NRA agenda, there's not a single Catholic leader I can think of that has. The Catholic position, while not loud enough, I've argued, is pretty uniform in favor of gun control. And I have tried to tell Congressman Ryan's bishop to remind him, but hasn't gotten anywhere. Ryan's Catholic. Yes?
Is there a reason why the NRA has opposed smarter gun control, smarter gun technology, so that only
Why has the NRA opposed smart gun technology? They've given their reasons. I think their reason was that these are another case of onerous regulations, you know, that manufacturers are going to have to jump through more hoops, and they're in the business of tearing down regulations. That's their official line. I suspect that the manufacturers in this country don't really want to pivot. The one case where this came up, it was actually a gun dealer in Maryland, where I'm from. He started to stock these. They're from a German manufacturer, and the NRA did not like that. I don't think the NRA, clearly the bulk of NRA beneficiaries are American manufacturers, and they didn't appreciate the competition. I think they probably didn't want to have to go through changing their product design. I think it's pretty flimsy, but that's all they said. So, thank you for the question. Other questions? Yes.
So, you touched a little bit on the stand your ground line.
Please stand up.
Maybe you should pat him down also. You pat down any of our speakers?
Maybe we should get a wand. You touched a little bit on stand your ground law and self-defense. I know we had to read the first and third chapters of your book, I think. In your second chapter, you talk about Locke's defense, mm-hmm. his issue of self-defense, which we didn't get to read. But that is one of the common things that evangelicals and Christians say,
yes.
Like we have a duty to protect our families. What's your general response when people raise that objection to you?
Sure. The question is, let me say this. I should repeat the question. The question is... gun rights advocates typically make a self-defense appeal when defending expansive gun ownership. In the late 1990s, if you asked people why they had a gun, the majority said for hunting. And then virtually overnight that changed. So that in the early 2000s, the majority of Americans say they have it for self-defense. Strange, but that's the NRA's game plan, because I may have mentioned, hunting's declining. Young hunters are declining in number, so hunting is not the future. It's got to be self-defense. John Locke, if there's any philosophers who can support and help the NRA, it would be John Locke, because he famously articulates the right to self-defense in the Second Treatise. He says that's one of the main reasons that we have a social contract at all. There's only one problem. When you join civil society, you transfer the right of self-defense. That's the whole point of civil society. You don't keep it. That doesn't say you can't have a gun. That just means that when it comes to, well, he's clearly writing against the notion of vigilante justice in the second treatise. But I have been arguing the stand your ground laws are a step in that direction, precisely. It's one thing, the transition that's happened in the NRA's agenda the last 15 years, and which is what I want to go back. I want to go back to, I'm actually very conservative. I want to go back to the old days. I want to go back to 2004, when guns were primarily in the home. I have no problem with a gun in your home. I would like to see them stored safely. What I've written about is this emergence of guns into the public sphere. And then, so in the classroom, maybe hopefully not here, in the classroom, on the street, apparently in bars and restaurants in Georgia, and churches. And then the laws that embolden people to use them, right? Stand your ground laws are the next component. It's not enough to just be able to carry your gun around. The NRA had to pursue stand your ground laws next so that people can be protected when they use them, right? What's the point in having... So the whole argument for open carry is that this is a deterrent. When I wear my gun on my hip, criminals know to leave me alone. Oh, but if they know that I'm not allowed to use my gun, then what's the point? Okay, now we need stand your ground. You understand? So that's why that's the next step. That's why that's legal in half the states in this country now. So my argument is that they get social contract theory exactly wrong, and they would return us to a state of nature, for those of you who read Hobbes and Locke, that wherever it's every person for him or himself. When the whole point of civil society is that as far as possible, you are to defer that power over another's life. You are to defer that power, transfer it to the civil authority you set up. So now you don't need to read chapter 2, because I just told you it. Other questions? Yes?
What is the sort of, what's your understanding of a kind of root motivation for the sort of radical ideas of the NRA? I think, you know, often I want to go to money. Is there some sort of financial benefit here? I think they play on fear a lot, but what's at the bottom for folks who are sort of driving all of that?
Well, when it comes to just the gun lobby themselves, the question is, what is the driving motivation of the gun lobby? And is it the gun lobby or the NRA members?
Yes.
Because I think you have to distinguish. I think the NRA members are kind of along for the ride. But it seems increasingly clear that the NRA is doing the bidding of the gun industry. They are a nonprofit. They're not required to reveal who their donors are, but it's pretty clear who writes their checks. I'm working on another piece. Here's a little preview, another article. The NRA they gave $30 million to the Trump campaign, which was the biggest investment they'd ever done, and it was unprecedented. And I remember last summer I wrote this beautiful article that I never submitted. I should have submitted at the time, where I was saying, this is the stupidest investment. This guy's going down in flames. You know, why would you do this? This is so dumb. And then he wins. Oh, you know. And so now the NRA looks good. But it wasn't going to turn out that way, right? At the time, it looked like an insane investment. And I've been arguing it was a sign of desperation. Those demographics I read you, that tells you all the story you need to know. They have no buying public anymore. They have no buying public. Who's going to buy their guns? Super owners are maxed out. They have 17 guns apiece. I think one of them lives next to my father-in-law. He has a giant arsenal, and I don't think he's going to buy anymore. Well, he might. It's just you can't rely. You need to expand. Some of you here may be taking courses in business. You have to understand. You have to expand your market. How are you going to do that? Well, one thing they decided is, well, let's sell various accessories to the owner. So, silencers, right? So Donald Trump Jr., the son, is in favor of a bill, I think it's called the Hearing Protection Bill. In case you haven't heard that title, I'm going to let that title sink in. The bill is nominally to protect the hearing of hunters. A lot of public health people are very worried what this could mean. In Baltimore City, when you hear pop, 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 you know a shooting's going on. With a silencer, you won't. Well, you won't. It won't be as loud. You'll still hear something, apparently. So, and armor-piercing bullets. They're going to sell the various accoutrements for the shooting, for the weapons. But the short answer is the manufacturers. They're doing the manufacturer's bidding. That's my analysis. Yes.
So you talked a little bit about the NRA's sort of chokehold on Congress, mm-hmm. but it seemed also optimistic.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. People ask me this all the time. The question is, why optimistic? Well, I'll tell you a couple things. First of all, can it get worse? Maybe you shouldn't answer that question. Well, it's pretty bad right now. Think about it. We don't have universal background checks. We have 300 million guns. And I was walking here today, and you have open carry in this state, and I felt pretty safe. And I didn't see a single gun owner walking by. I didn't see a single shooting. So that's pretty good. And for the vast majority of us, that's our life, right? There is, of course, a particularly afflicted minority. I'm thinking of where I live in Baltimore, East and West Baltimore. They live in a veritable war zone. They are in favor of gun control. Mm-hmm. The suburbs where the violence does not happen, they're in favor of gun rights. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now I forgot your question already.
Why are you optimistic?
Right. So I'm optimistic is a couple of reasons. It can't get worse, I don't think. It's already pretty bad. Just imagine what we could do if we had background checks. Just imagine. Those numbers would improve. A couple of the reasons for optimism. I told you the poll numbers about Americans, how they feel on this issue. The majority are against it. The market for gun buyers has dried up. The gun buying public is diminishing. The piece I wrote last summer about Trump and the NRA was arguing that the NRA, their clock is ticking. I still think that way. It doesn't matter what that they've won this election. That's fine. Their prime demographic is diminishing. The bulk of NRA owners are, they're a very predictable demographic. It is white, middle-aged, lower middle class. The gun buying demographics among the youth is diminishing greatly. Another thing, the NRA used to have bipartisan support. Not anymore. They don't have a single Democrat except for Joe Manchin in West Virginia on their, and his time is nearing ending. But they don't have a single Democrat anymore. Now they're completely the party of right wing, and they're going even more to the right, which means they're marginalizing themselves politically. Last thing I will say, the gun safety movement doesn't have nearly the money as the NRA, but they're starting. And one of their big beneficiaries is Bloomberg, former Mayor Michael Bloomberg, New York. He has given them a good deal of money.
Former Republican. Maybe.
Former Republican, more like an independent.
Yeah, right.
But they are attracting some funding. This last election was the first presidential election in like 12 years where the Democrat actually campaigned on gun control. You have to remember, Obama didn't even mention it. Mm-hmm. Didn't come up until Sandy Hook, and that was after his second election. So that was taboo at the time. Democrats knew this was a sensitive issue. Now Democrats feel no inkling of being pro-gun rights. They don't have to apologize to NRA. And the last thing I would say is this. So Bloomberg's funded gun safety benefactors, they discovered a new tactic. The NRA is really good at corrupting politicians. They put them on their payroll, and then they threaten them. And so the gun safety movement said, why don't we put gun safety measures right on the ballot unattached to politicians. And in this last election, which was a bloodbath for Democrats, they won 3 out of 4 ballots measures. They did really well. And it speaks to what I was saying. When you ask the voters how they feel about gun safety, they vote for it. So that's why I'm an optimist about it. Please.
What's the solution, I think is my question. Because I think you posed a lot of problems in the last statistics, and I feel like the answer just can't be more gun control laws, because especially with the Congress and the president right now, it's definitely not going to happen in the next 4 years at least. So what happens next? Do we just wait?
Mm-hmm. Good question. His question is, what's the solution? That's a big question. Or what do we do in the next 4 years? I do think a lot of the laws are in place, but the problem is we're not enacting them. I mean, we have a background check system. It's just that it's very poorly enforced. The states are required to put people into that system if, for example, they have mental or emotional ailments or mental illness. There was a famous shooting a few years ago, maybe it was just last year or the year before, where a guy walked into a movie theater in Louisiana and he shot some people and killed 2 girls. It turns out he had been reported for domestic abuse, and he had been hospitalized for mental illness. But he lived in Alabama and Georgia, and they are the two worst states for putting people's names into the background check system. They just don't do it. So we have this background check system. I want to see it universal. I don't see much hope or much use for Maryland's, where I live, Maryland's universal background check system. When you know, criminals in Baltimore City, they can just go to West Virginia and buy their weapons. I don't see the point. So, you know, I think that's one law that would help. I do think safe storage laws would help as well.
Longer waiting periods. Dylan,
longer waiting periods.
Been able to purchase weapons in South Carolina had the state had more than a 48-hour waiting period. The FBI had flagged his application and
sure.
Took longer than the 48-hour period, and so he was able to return and pick up his guns.
I mean, I think this. I think
simple law.
I think the solution is making guns less easily accessible, and I think making our national arsenal smaller. And so I think all these NRA laws to make guns more common in our culture, for example, these open. I think that's their offensive. With campus carry, they're trying to get you guys to be gun owners and gun carriers. They want to make this more common. I think those are some laws that should be revoked. I think campus carry, open carry, they should be revoked. And I absolutely think permitless carry is a disaster. I do not understand why you would want people in your state carrying guns without safety training. I don't get it.
If you live in a stand your ground state and you see someone open carrying, does that constitute grounds for shooting that person? If you, since you would feel understandably threatened?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, the real problem with that law is that it is being interpreted differently by judges. Some judges will find that it's all the one. Speak to legal scholars about this. This is why this law is so disastrous. Mm-hmm. There's no uniform application. One judge will be persuaded, another judge will not. One of the most common variables, the race of the shooter, or the race of the shot. Cases where the victim is African American, the shooter, I think, has a much better chance of getting immunity.
Well, on that.
I know, that was a sobering note. I'm still optimistic.
We are so grateful for your voice.
Thank
and
you.
For your gift of being here today.
Thank you.